Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome in. It's 82 degrees under sunny skies, a little humid out there here in the swamps, and we welcome those of you on Blog Talk Radio and the Golf News Net Radio Network and on iTunes. You can find us anytime now on iTunes. Go to podcasts and search Teeing It Up, and we are so glad that you can be with us every week. Once a week on Mondays, live on Blog Talk Radio for the time being at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, and anytime on archive on not only Blog Talk Radio, but also the great folks at iTunes. We welcome our new audience. This is not a golf show. The picture shows golf, but half our guests are golf-related. So I know it can seem like it's a golf show, but we truly will talk about anything and everything. And occasionally we'll throw in weird things like, well, not weird, but just unique, different things like what it's like to propose to your girlfriend or what is it like to get married. We're going to continue that series eventually with what a honeymoon is like. I would love for somebody to join me on their honeymoon. If you are interested in calling into a radio show from your honeymoon, please let me know. And today we have the co-host of the other show I host, the Sunday show, during football season. Teeing It Up presents the Sunday Sprint during the National Football League season. Luke Morrow will join us, one of the voices of the Binghamton Mets, the new voice of Stetson football, and he will join us coming up here in about 3 minutes. We always start with golf on Teeing It Up, and we are going to start with what we saw yesterday, which is 51-year-old Davis Love III winning the Wyndham Championship, third oldest winner in PGA Tour history, and it's a big win for obvious reasons, a historic win, and I'm happy, ecstatic for Davis Love to prove to everybody that you can still compete and win at that age, especially when you've had surgeries and have had trouble walking and pain and everything that Davis went through for the current Ryder Cup captain. It is truly a fantastic win. But, you know, and I try not to talk about Tiger every time Tiger plays because he does get repetitive. But he made major progress this week. And, yes, people will look at the triple at 11 and the bogey at 12. But what they're forgetting is that Tiger put himself in that position. What they're forgetting is that Tiger finally had the slow start that all of us expected he would have, and he had it at the wrong time. He had it Sunday in the front nine. And when you get in that spot, and now you find yourself two, three, four shots behind, I think he was – what is it, 16 under at that point, the lead was? Whatever it was, when you find yourself behind an eight ball like that, you have to push it. And he was clearly trying to play some sort of a chip shot, some sort of running, bump and run-ish chip shot that didn't work. He bladed it. Then he fluffed the next one when he had to be really careful. But that's not the point. The point for me is how he bounced back. Now, yes, when you're out of it, the tension goes away. It's a lot easier to play when you're coming from behind with nothing to lose. You can go right flags, make dumb decisions. It doesn't matter. But we've seen this year Tiger get checked out mentally. And he bounced back this time and made four birdies over his last five holes, six holes, whatever it was, and eventually got back to 1,300 par and shot an even par 70. Earlier this year, that round was 75 or 76, if not higher. This time, 70. Really impressive stuff, and he had a look on 17 as well. So that could have very easily have gotten even under par, even with the triple and the bogey at 12. It just shows you what can happen when you put it together and when you when you finally get the pieces feeling right, not only can you play well to get yourself in contention, but you can bounce back after you fall out of contention and hit a speed bump. That's what was really impressive to me from Tiger Woods yesterday. He is on the way back, and we'll win before long, folks.
And we welcome to Teeing It Up, this first episode of Teeing It Up, that besides being on Blog Talk Radio, and besides being on the Golf News Net Radio Network, is also on that big thing in the world called iTunes. iTunes, Luke Morrow. We're on iTunes, the co-host with me of the Sunday Sprint, all those football mornings, and a man who's a great friend and colleague, Mr. Luke Morrow. Hello.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be on your show once again, and I'm glad you didn't forget the little people as you make it big time on iTunes. You're still gracious enough to have me on.
Well, you are not a little person. You are a very powerful fella.
Well, I appreciate the kind words and the exaggerations.
You are, after all, the voice of the Binghamton Mets, or one of, and that organization has seen a lot of people who could have a big impact on a Met playoff run. So, you know, you are a big man and have power. But first, we have to start with your beloved Red Sox. Ben Sherrington is gone, and it has to be one of the quirkiest tenures of any recent GM, because the Red Sox have either been on top of the world or have been horrible.
I know. It's something. And so it's kind of tough to determine which is the fluke, the World Series team that he put together, or the three last-place teams. But I guess those last-place teams have been more frequent in his tenure. I guess the World Series could be considered the fluke. So it's odd to get get a read on his really short time as the GM in Boston. And even the same goes for John Farrell, the World Series championship and now back-to-back last-place finishes, and a decision going to have to be made on him. But yeah, it's interesting to see a team go from last place to World Series champs and then back to last place for the next 2 years. And I know me personally, I wasn't the biggest Ben Sherrington fan. I'll never forget what he brought to the team in terms of that World Series. But with that said, and the short memory that you have in sports, I thought it was time for a change.
Is there something wrong with John Henry and the ownership? Because everybody, you know, when you have these weird runs, you know, everybody who's a Yankee fan knows that when George Steinbrenner was aggravated, he'd send off his missive and, you know, and all, you know, terror and fear would rain down upon thee. Do you think that this is a more baseball operations issue, or is this something that from the top down, when the Red Sox finally broke the curse, that over this last 11-year period, the mission statement from ownership and just the overall feeling around the club has changed?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And, you know, I don't want to sound like a spoiled Red Sox fan now, because we do have the three World Series, you know, under these guys compared to what had happened in the previous 86 years. So, you know, but times have changed for a Red Sox fan. Well, now that you do have that World Series, you continue to expect to compete year in and year out. And there's been a lot written and said about the owners. And I've always been one that liked owners that weren't hands-on. Just provide the money, provide the assets to allow other guys to do their job. And that's why you hire a GM. That's why you bring in a Dave Dombrowski, you know, a president of baseball operations, et cetera, because they know what they're doing. And, you know, George Steinbrenner had success. We know how hands-on he could be. But that even took time for him. So I've always been one for owners just sitting back and letting guys do what they can do. And we've heard stories now after Ben Sherrington gets fired of where he was put under pressure, where he was rushed into some things from owners. We know Terry Francona wrote a book when he was let go about his time in Boston, talking about once the Red Sox got that first World Series, then they started to concentrate a little more on some other things. And with Tom Warner being one of the principal owners, also owning Nesson, Francona felt that the team, that they were more concerned about ratings, and that's why they went into the offseason a few years back with the mission to sign quote-unquote sexy guys like Carl Crawford, Adrian Gonzalez. And we knew how that worked out. So I think once they got the first World Series, that guys like John Henry, Tom Warner, Larry Lucchino, the guys running that team, their mindset kind of shifted. And on top of that, like I said, just being a little too hands-on. You know, Dave Dombrowski, there's been a lot made about whether he's really into analytics or not, et cetera, et cetera. And John Henry's a guy who's really pushed that, or really has pushed the Red Sox to the forefront of using analytics. And it seems like that's going to be something that they're going to push onto Dombrowski as well, where I think if you're going to hire somebody, you know, let him be him. That's why you're hiring him. So combination of a few things, but I think it does start at the top, and I think there's a more than just Ben Cherington responsible.
Talking to our great friend Luke Morrow, where does fried chicken and beer fall in your assessment of the Cherington era?
That's an interesting thing because, you know, people say after that whole thing came out in 2011, and a lot of old baseball folks said that was blown out of proportion, that happened, that was much more common than you would think, so on and so forth. And then, you know, that led to the shakeup and the hiring of Bobby Valentine, which, of course, that was a disaster for a handful of reasons, where the Red Sox tried to shift from going from a player manager to a tough manager, and that was a decision put onto Cherington by Larry Lucchino. And so as a GM, your first move is to hire your new manager, and you don't even get to make that decision. So maybe that was foreshadowing for how his tenure was going to go. We just didn't know it at the time. And 2012 turned out to be a disaster. And then Cherington kind of saved things by getting to the World Series and, of course, winning in 2013. And he thought, okay, well, now when he actually has the opportunity to bring in this guy to do his stuff, we can see, you know, how smart he is as a baseball mind, as a general manager. And then you go to the last place finishes. So it's been a very peculiar 4 years with the Red Sox, with Cherington, and with that whole front office, and along with Cherington, the shakeup now of Larry Lucchino, who's very hands-on, also on his way out at the end of the year. So some changes in Boston just over the last couple of weeks, and I expect more in the coming months.
Talking with Luke Morrow here. Luke, as you look at the baseball landscape now, shifting to what the Mets are doing, the Mets are obviously on a run. They made big moves at the trade deadline, including Yoenis Cespedes. And now they want to skip pitchers, which is always an interesting thing when you want to save arms and pitch counts and innings limits, and there's no real proof that any of that makes a difference. I obviously want to ask you to critique what they're doing, but this does open the door for a lot of people, including September call-ups. Who that you've seen that's come through Binghamton do you think could be an interesting presence for the big league club, as the Mets not only have September call-ups, but have to redo some things in their rotation here?
Well, there's been quite a bit of talent in Binghamton, and that's why the B-Mets have been fortunate to have such a successful season this year. But I think a big guy for the New York Mets moving forward here the rest of the season and in the future is a guy who we've already seen in New York and now will be making a return to Binghamton this week, and Steven Matz. You know, just make sure to get him healthy, get him back, because we've seen what he can do at the big league level. He's another arm that's ready to go, as opposed to trying to bring up a minor leaguer, maybe making his debut and unsure of what he's going to be able to provide. So, you know, Steven Matz is a young talent. We know what he's capable of already in a very short time at the big leagues, but it was promising. And so to get him healthy and just to add another arm into that starting rotation that's already so good will be so beneficial for the team heading down the stretch. And on top of that, Matz, going through this injury, it has cut down some of his innings, so looking at the glass half full, he may be a little fresher than a different guy at this point in the season. So, you know, I think he'll be a big help. Should be back, you know, they're hoping soon. And you throw him in the mix with other guys, and he could take some of the load off Matt Harvey and get that team lined up nicely for hopefully a nice October run.
excuse me. And it's interesting because this Mets team finally got the offense to match their pitching. That's what everybody was waiting for, was when would Sandy Alderson spend money to up the offense, and they have. And now you end up in this interesting problem of young arms and trying to win a championship. Take out what the Mets are doing. Just in general, your perspective as a fan of a team. So if you were rooting for a team, if the Red Sox had all these loaded arms, and you obviously wanting to see the team you've rooted for since you were a kid win a title, it's an interesting question. Do you want to preserve health, even though I don't believe I've ever seen any documented evidence that it actually does it, versus trying to go for a championship?
Are you talking in terms of the number of starting pitchers or trading off prospects to bring in, you know, guys to help now?
Oh, sorry. Saving pitchers, skipping starts, innings limits, etc.
Yeah. You know, it depends on the situation. In general, I've never been a big fan of six-man rotation because we've been, you know, going at five men for however many years, and overall, there really hasn't been an issue with it. But it depends on the situation. When you have a guy that maybe you could cut down the innings of, or you have a couple of pitchers that are still working their way back from injury, their first year back from Tommy John, whatever it may be, then yeah, it could work out for you if you have the six talented pitchers that you're willing to throw out there. Then in a situation like that, you know, sure, go for it. But we've seen even the Los Angeles Dodgers recently here go to a four-man rotation because with off days, it will line up as if they still had five guys. And on top of that, you get Kershaw and Greinke a little more frequently than you would in a five-man. So I think it all depends on the team. In general, no, I've always preferred five-man over six, but there are certain instances where I would agree with the six-man rotation and where I think it is certainly beneficial. So it depends on the team, and if you could even pull off a four guy like the Dodgers, I think that makes sense for them as well. So it's whatever works for you in that particular time frame or season.
Talking with Luke Morrow here about great things in the world of sports. Let's change subjects for a second here. And I want to move to basketball for a second. Carmelo Anthony, and this is what I find so fascinating about having all power. Carmelo Anthony is working out with all his teammates this week in Puerto Rico, having a nice little vacation. And, you know, he's on record at the USA basketball camp last week of saying, I'm fine with free agency, I'm fine with who we drafted, I'm fine with what Phil Jackson did after there were some reports that he wasn't. And you look out at the landscape of what the NBA is, and J.R. Smith goes back to the Cavs so they get a shooter again. And obviously the way all that played out with Golden State getting their first championship. And my question to you, Luke, is, As a player, how much influence do you think a player, a star player like Carmelo or LeBron or Kobe or Steph Curry or Derrick Rose should have on what their team does in free agency and in the draft?
A lot less than they currently have. That's a big issue for me with the NBA, is that, one, everything's based around free agency, both the upcoming and years ahead, and two, that really the inmates run the asylum in the NBA, and that's a problem. The first point being free agency is such a big key in the NBA because that's a sport, that's a league that it's become where if you get one or two stars, you can win a championship. So, you know, who's going to become available is such a big thing. And so I always go to the example of when Derek Fisher was hired in New York, and his big selling point at his introductory press conference was that he felt he could bring in Kevin Durant when he becomes a free agent, I think like 3 years. Like, well, that's great, but what are you going to do in your first 3 years on the job? We're not hiring you for 2018. So free agency to me is such a big focus in the NBA that I think it's a problem. And then the other point in your original question being about the players, I think it's ridiculous. I mean, being an Orlando Magic fan, I grew up as a huge Penny Hardaway fan, and he's still my favorite all-time player in the history of the NBA. But Penny Hardaway has forced Orlando to fire the most successful coach in franchise history, Brian Hill, in the 90s after an NBA appearance because they didn't get along. And it took for Magic a while and really never got back to that point for the rest of Penny's career. And it certainly backfired. And we've heard of Kobe having say in what coaches are brought in, what coaches are let go. Michael Jordan, you know, LeBron, so on and so forth. So I think to a certain point, if Carmelo were to go to the Knicks and recommend, like, hey, I think you should take a look at so-and-so, we would work well together, we would fit the, he could fit our system, we played together, whatever it may be, something like that, yeah, that input could certainly be helpful in the NBA because, again, it only takes maybe one or two big pieces to turn around a team. So something like that. But when a player is almost running the team and is making the decisions on who exactly you're going after, what coach you hire, so on and so forth, which is what's going on in the NBA right now, then I think you have an issue, and I think that is an issue.
And what's interesting about all of this stuff is that here you have your Magic, and it feels like, because this must be interesting as a Magic fan, because at some point, you must feel like with no big stars in your team, every single move you have to do is right. And yet none of that gets the headlines, none of that gets analyzed, and all we hear about all day is Melo happy with his people? Is LeBron happy with his people? Is LeBron happy with David Blatt? It's a very interesting dichotomy between the haves and the have-nots, in a sense.
Yeah, and I think that plays into my point, and it's certainly a star-driven league, and maybe that's true for every sport, but maybe not so much for the NBA, and maybe it's best that way, and I shouldn't be complaining, but, you know, it's all about guys like LeBron and Carmelo, and no one really cares. Like, Orlando has put together a good young group of talent that may be just one or two tweaks away from possibly, you know, competing for a playoff spot. So, you know, as a Magic fan, I'm happy with what they've done the past couple of years. I think they've stockpiled some good talent. They just need a few more pieces. But it's always going to be about the stars, about the handful of guys, and that's really all that people seem to be interested in. So I think no matter what happens, you'll always hear about the Michael Jordan, about the Kobe Bryant, about the LeBrons, the Carmelo Anthony's, those headline grabbers that always seem to not only get people's attention, but also just make headlines themselves. So that's the way the NBA's been, for better or worse.
Let's now switch to the National Football League, because as you know, this is the league where they play for pay, as you may have heard. If Jordy Nelson is gone for the year with a knee, and by the time the show airs, he may be gone for the year with a knee, it really makes things interesting for the Packers, because we saw for years and have seen for years with Peyton Manning and Tom Brady the ability to take less than stellar wide receivers, these are not Chris Carters and Jerry Rices, and make them into guys who play like Chris Carter and Jerry Rice. And this is what Aaron Rodgers is going to have to do now with the loss of one of his favorite targets.
And it's a big loss. I think Jordy Nelson last year is probably a top five, certainly a top 10 receiver in my mind. He posted huge numbers, and even the year prior. So it's a big loss for the Packers. But if any team could overcome it, the Packers may be the top choice to do so. And they're obviously going to have to do so. But you hear Mike McCarthy get credited so much with how brilliant of an offensive mind he is. So, you know, he'll certainly help ease the transition, if you will, without Jordy Nelson. But to me, Aaron Rodgers right now is the best quarterback in the league. And I think I felt that way, certainly last year and probably the year prior. In my opinion, he surpassed Tom Brady. He has surpassed Peyton Manning. And I would take Aaron Rodgers over any other quarterback right now. And I think Rodgers, to a certain extent, has already done what Brady and Manning have done in making others better. You look at the team that he won the Super Bowl with, and even some of the other teams he brought to the playoffs, pretty lousy offensive line, not much of a run game, and the majority of the years, not a very good defense. And you always watch those teams. Being a Vikings fan, I watch just about every one of their games and watch them play the Vikings twice a year, and I always wondered how they won so many games they did, because on paper, and even watching them on tape, I never felt they were as talented as they seemed. I always thought the Packers, through all these years, even with Jordy Nelson and some of those weapons now, more recently in the pass game, I've always felt they've overachieved, and I think that's because Mike McCarthy as a coach and Aaron Rodgers, who makes up for so much. You don't need a good run game. You don't need a good pass protection. You don't need a great defense when you have Aaron Rodgers at quarterback. So this may be an even tougher test now when you take away his favorite weapon, but I think we've already seen Rodgers make guys better around him, and I think he'll continue to do that this year.
Talking with our great friend Luke Marr, the co-host of the Sunday Sprint, which returns September 13th to Blog Talk Radio, the Golf News Net Radio Network, and iTunes. How do you feel your Vikes are doing so far?
I'm happy. I was thinking about it today, and I think this is the most excited I've been for a football season in quite a while, and not even so much because of the Vikings, because I don't want to put, you know, expectations on them. I'd rather just fly under the radar. But just for football as a whole to be back, you know, I don't really know why, but I'm just really anxious for it, maybe because of the lack of success for the Red Sox of late. So I'm just excited for the NFL season. I like what I've seen from the Vikings. It means absolutely nothing, but they're now 7-0 in preseason games under Mike Zimmer. And I think they've played pretty well in their first three preseason games this year with still some things to clean up. So I like the roster. I like what I've seen throughout the preseason, and I'm looking forward to week one, not only for them, but the whole league, and then also for the restart of our show this year.
Think Tim Tebow makes it?
Ooh. You know, I don't know. You hear good things from Chip Kelly and his evaluation of Tebow. That just may be lip service. I'm surprised he's already gotten this far. And when he originally signed, I thought no way he'd be on the roster week one. So I think it's more likely now than I originally thought. But we'll see. The action I saw from him, he looked good in his first preseason series and then did not look very good the next couple of series where he seemed to be shaky and not cool, calm, or collected in the pocket. So from what I've seen, I think he still has plenty to work on, but we'll see what happens.
What's interesting about all this is so many people focus on Adrian Peterson coming back, but Adrian Peterson doesn't play in the preseason, and yet he goes out there and does crazy things in the regular season. It's amazing to me that so many guys pull hamstrings and stuff like that who don't get a lot of playing time. We saw this with Chris Johnson already, who was out of camp for a while and then comes in and plays poorly so he gets hurt. But Adrian Peterson goes in there and plays well week one. Why do you think he avoids or has avoided some of the problems that have beset other players?
Yeah, I think he's just an athletic freak. When he blew up his knee a couple years back, had to get the surgery after tearing, you know, ACL, MCL, every ligament there is in the knee. The doctors said that it was the craziest thing they said they saw when they cut him open and do the operation, that of all the surgeries they've done on people who have blown out their knees, his looked the least severe, despite it being just as severe. He's just there's really no way to explain it. I don't think he's just an athletic freak. And he came back from that surgery of people doubting, thinking that would be the start of the decline in his career. We know what he did the first year back, and now same thing. People are worried. Oh, Adrian Peterson, a year off. How's he going to respond? They say he's in the best physical shape of his life. He spent the year just getting bigger, stronger, faster. Didn't have to take the hits, so he has a year less of hits on him than he would at this point. And we'll see how he comes out in week one. A concern for me, though, is that the field that they're going to play at week one in San Francisco has been questionable. And they've gotten all sort of headlines and complaints about the playing surface out there in San Francisco in their new stadium. Similar to that, we know the bad reputation of Heinz Field and that playing surface. We just talked about Jordy Nelson, and he tore potentially his ACL on a non-contact play on that field. So the playing surface is important, and then AP's first came back in almost a full calendar year. It's going to be on a playing surface that the San Francisco Niners have even had to come off of during practice because of how bad the field conditions are. So that's the biggest concern for me.
And that Tony Romo threatened not to play on because it was so poor. Luke Morrow, the co-host of the Sunday Sprint Teeing It Up Presents, which returns September 13th at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Luke, thanks as always for coming on Teeing It Up with Jeremy Schilling.
My pleasure as always, and I look forward to that first show back.
Thanks for joining us, everybody. We will see you next week.